Sir Charles, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you. A pleasure and a privilege as usual, Art.
Yeah, great to have you back on. You're an intelligent guy. And before we dive into the material on Mars, I want to ask a couple of questions about fields you've worked in. America's starving for energy. The pump prices are now, you know, like the top news story everywhere. It's a big deal. You worked on nuclear fusion. Nuclear fusion is one possible answer to some of our problems. So how far have we come with nuclear fusion, and is it, in fact, a possible answer to our looming crisis?
It is a possible answer, and there are a number of ways it's going right now. The research in high-temperature fusion, which is almost always done with magnetic fields to hold the plasma in place, has made some advances. Russia appears to be pursuing something called helium-3 fusion, which has the advantage of being very clean. It doesn't emit a lot of neutron radiation as opposed to typical hydrogen fusion.
Are they able to contain it?
Well, from what I understand, they're making some advances, but I think that's not quite as important as what it implies. You see, the biggest supply of helium-3 is on the moon.
Ah.
And that would mean that they would have to go to the moon to get their fuel.
Does anybody have any idea why there is so much helium-3 on the moon as opposed to Earth? I mean, supposedly, the moon was once part of Earth, many people contend, so why would it have a large amount of helium-3?
It's because cosmic radiation and particles from the sun and other stars land on the lunar surface and stick to the rocks and soil there.
So it's its origin is not with the moon, but what the moon has collected.
That's correct.
Huh. Okay, learn something every day. Why is helium-3 that much better?
Because when you fuse hydrogen, whatever form of hydrogen you have, typically there's a lot of energy but also neutron radiation released. Helium-3 fuses cleanly. It doesn't give off a great deal of neutron radiation. In fact, it's referred to as aneutronic because it has such a low radiation level. So it wouldn't make the reactor containment vessels become radioactive over time, as typical hydrogen fusion vessels would. So it has a number of advantages.
Do we have deposits of helium-3 on Earth, or are they just very rare, or what?
Well, it's extremely rare on Earth because our only source of helium on Earth tends to be from gas mines. We get it from underground.
Right.
And so that helium has to be sorted out by its isotopes. Certain helium has more or less neutrons on average. And the helium that we normally deal with has an atomic mass of 4. It has 2 neutrons and 2 protons in it. So helium-3 is a little odd because it's missing a neutron. And we have to literally sort out the individual atoms of helium-3 from the bulk of helium-4 that we collect from mines underground.
Okay. I remember a lot of stories indicating that fusion had only been achieved for a very tiny instant. Is that still the case?
Actually, you know, the instants in which they have the fusion occurring are still pretty brief, but what they're doing to overcome that is they're going to be firing it very rapidly. So you will have it being done repetitively, and overall you'll get a large amount of energy on average.
All right. Well, one big problem, of course, with nuclear reactors now is that it ends up with the kind of stuff that's about to be stored in my backyard.
Right, yes, that would be a problem. If you're using reactors that are fueled with deuterium or tritium or normal hydrogen, then that would be a problem. Over time, the reactor vessels do become radioactive, and they would have to be decommissioned and stored as waste.
Well, you actually had, a grant given to you to work on nuclear fusion. At the point that you finished your work, what had you concluded about its viability?
We discovered that there was a definite effect and that fusion did appear to be occurring in the cells. We were getting a lot more energy out than we were putting in.
Mm-hmm.
However, that has now changed gears. And, you know, we talked momentarily about sonoluminescence, where they use ultrasound to create fusion through cavitation. That was studied, but it didn't really seem to go very far. Recently, a new advance in cold fusion is they're using something called a crystal, a thermoelectric crystal, and it creates extremely intense voltage fields that can confine the protons and make them fuse.
Really?
So that looks like it's going to be a very viable method of doing it. And so far, the signature that they were looking for, the production of neutron radiation, is present, which proves the process is working.
Well, Sir Charles, we're approaching I think, an absolute economic meltdown or some sort of crisis as a result of energy. I mean, everybody can see it around them now. It's no longer any sort of secret. So something like this or something else is going to have to come along to save our butts. I mean, it really is, or we're just in big trouble.
Well, yes. You know, it's interesting because one of the things we've often discussed is orbital solar power. And it turns out that Mitsubishi Corporation is promoting a scheme to place a microwave satellite in orbit, powered by sunlight, to beam the microwaves down into city areas and to use the beam to power cell phones and laptops and PDAs.
Really? Oh, really? What an intriguing idea. So, in other words, the energy could be spread out on Earth instead of tightly beamed to power devices, handheld devices, that sort of thing?
That's right.
What about the environmental impact of doing such a thing?
Well, of course, they've looked at the same problems that we've investigated, such as how it will interact with the atmosphere and other things on the ground.
Right.
And they've concluded that they can easily get it to pass through the atmosphere and have almost no effect on the environment, and that only a tuned receiver will pick up any significant amount of the power.
And effects on the biological organisms walking around us?
Well, you know, the energy levels are so minute, it appears it's not going to have any effect. And, you know, that brings up another point. I remember that just after the last show I did, you had a call from the author of Sunstroke, David Kagan.
That's right.
Yes, and he said that he was elated that somebody was actually pursuing the idea.
Absolutely correct, yes. David Kagan, he's kind of a friend of mine, and he wrote Sunstroke. And you know the premise of that book, right?
That
a satellite is put up to beam down energy, and that, of course, obviously, science fiction, something goes wrong. The satellite begins to wander in orbit and turn people into French fries as it goes.
Yes, well, what I wanted to point out, and I think he wasn't truly aware of the amount of energy involved. If you have a piece of, let's say, a steak in the microwave or a piece of meat in the microwave, it would be barbaric to do a steak, but let's say some piece of meat.
Hmm.
You generally get an energy level of about 5 watts per square centimeter cooking the meat. There is a thin piece of perforated metal stuck in the glass window of your microwave.
Mm-hmm.
And that little piece of perforated metal blocks the signal, and you don't get cooked.
Right.
It takes very little to block that signal. Of course, you always see the signs that say, you know, users of pacemakers, stay away from the microwave. But personally, I've never seen anybody have any difficulty. I've never certainly seen anybody drop dead from having a pacemaker around the microwave.
Now, I stand in front of it all the time waiting for my coffee. So,
well, there you go. And so that bit of metal is enough to shield you from any effects, and that's a very energetic beam. By comparison, sunlight would be about 96 milliwatts, or thousandths of a watt per square centimeter. Far less dense, about 50 times less dense than what you're getting from microwaving a piece of meat in the microwave oven. And the microwave power beam from the power satellites would be about 23 milliwatts, one-fourth of that level.
So they're seriously considering launching such a satellite. That would mean, folks, that your cell phones, your PDAs and other small devices would be powered from space. In other words, no more batteries, no more batteries going dead on you in the middle of a phone call, that kind of thing, because you have no battery. That's
correct. That's exactly right.
That's incredible.
That's just the tip of the iceberg, you know.
Well, yes. And, of course, the next question is about a Kagan kind of scenario. Is it reasonable, is it economically feasible to put a spacecraft in orbit to collect sunlight and then microwave it back to Earth? The safety
Absolutely.
Part of it we'll put off for a moment. Is it technically and economically feasible?
Absolutely, yes it is. In fact, you know, I had talked to you about Gene Myers and his efforts to put a system up for his launch system and how we were cooperating about orbital powered stations.
Yes.
And he was speaking in terms of $10 billion for the project over 7 years, but that includes the development of the entire launch system. If you were simply putting up a demonstrator power satellite, you could probably do it for as low as $3 billion if you weren't using reusable hardware. So we're talking about something that's actually quite doable when you consider what it costs to build power plants or gasoline cracking plants
mm-hmm.
to produce fuel, then you're not far off. In fact, I live in Orlando, and Universal is down here, the theme park, and they spent over $3 billion on their expansion. just a few years ago.
Huh.
And that's a theme park.
Right.
So if you're looking at $3 billion and you look at a theme park or an orbital power system, you know, the choice is clear if you're trying to make money on energy where you're going
to
go.
All right. Give me a few figures. I would be very interested to know, for example, how much power an orbital station could collect. And then I'd be also very interested in how much it could actually deliver. In other words, the efficiency of the transfer.
Okay. If you had a station, and typically they quote one the size of Manhattan Island, it would collect roughly enough to be equivalent to about 120 large power plants. And
holy
by the time
smokes.
You converted it to electrical power and beamed it to the ground in the form of microwaves,
yes.
You could collect between 30 and 60 billion watts, depending on your efficiency. So you could replace between 30 and 60 power plants at the bottom line.
My God. And you think this could be done for how much money?
I believe the first setup could be done in orbit and flying for roughly $3 billion.
$3 billion. That would be a demonstrator craft.
That's correct, but understand that once it's up there, it provides the economic impetus to complete the system, to build more of them. And once you've got money coming in, people are going to sign on. Anybody who sees an opportunity like this will invest in it.
Oh, I estimate perhaps.
We could replace 85% of our fuel consumption if we went to orbital solar power.
Do we have the do we have collectors that are efficient enough now and would withstand the environment of space for a long period of time?
Well, it depends on the design. There are two competing designs right now. Solar cells or photovoltaics that convert sunlight directly into electricity
Right. Actually
are a little delicate and a little expensive to make, and they have a limited lifespan. They have about a 20% conversion efficiency.
Huh.
So in my mind, solar cells really wouldn't be your best bet. If you went to a mechanical system where you actually had steam boilers, collected the sunlight with reflectors and lenses,
and actually
water,
made steam in space in boilers.
And run it through a turbine, that's correct. And you can get about 89% conversion efficiency there.
So wait a minute, you're saying the turbine would be in space?
That's correct.
That's a lot of weight, buddy.
Well, actually, no. There are a number of compact turbines in development right now, and you'd be amazed at some of the efficiencies you can get out of them. And they can be made out of very lightweight materials. But
really?
Not only that, your generators can use some of the new generations of super magnets, which are extremely lightweight, and get very good efficiencies out of them. So a lot of your mass of copper and iron can be removed by using very intense magnetic fields generated by the new rare earth magnets. And if you wanted to, you could even go to superconductors, which could outperform them even further. So when you come down to it, I did a mass calculation, and typically, for the mass of material that you'd have to orbit for solar cells, you could get about four times the power for the equivalent mass in generators and turbines.
Now, you mentioned superconductivity. That would perhaps seem practical in the temperatures in space.
Yes, and that's an absolutely perfect point. You don't have to cool superconductors once they're down to their operating temperatures if you keep them in the shade.
Uh-huh.
It would take little or no refrigeration for the superconductors to run as long as you didn't hit them with direct sunlight and warm them up.
Okay, so that would mean some sort of shield, even there, I guess, huh?
That's correct. Well, what you would do is you'd put the same sort of cryogenic insulation you use on Earth. You'd have a silver reflector on the front that was opaque to their sunlight, and you'd have a reflector on the back that would keep any Earth shine from hitting the thing as well. And once the things had been chilled down, by letting them be exposed to blackness of space, which is basically about 3 degrees Kelvin, extremely cold, then they would reach their operating point and remain there.
Boy, that's fascinating. And where do you think such a beam would come back to Earth? If you were in charge of such a project and you had to designate a place where you'd bring it back, now remember, you've got to keep it fairly near an entrance point for the grid, right?
That's true. You know, I would actually recommend that it be done in some of the outlying areas around cities where people place things such as landfills. Think about your landfill having the receiving antenna spread out for square miles around, and nobody wants to live near the landfill anyway.
Right.
What an ideal environment.
I suppose.
And other possibilities would be...
Wouldn't it turn the landfill into JC's steaming pit of sewage?
Actually,
heating it up or something?
No. That's a funny thought, but actually it wouldn't. Remember, the receiving antenna for this thing would operate in the same way that the shield in the door of your microwave oven does. The signal can't get through it. It's absorbed.
So it would not affect...
That's correct. It wouldn't affect the ground or anything under it.
You're really sure of that?
Absolutely.
I mean, that is the big worry, of course.
That's true. See, you've got two things working on your side. The power density is only a quarter of sunlight. And remember, for the microwave oven, you've got about 5 watts per square centimeter. For this beam, you've got about 0.023.
Boy, that's low.
Per square centimeter.
Yeah.
And that same sort of metal shield in the door of your microwave blocks out that 5 watt per square centimeter density.
Right. All right.
And it's perfectly effective.
All right. How big a field of antennas? I'm sorry to be jumping ahead like this, but I'm curious.
Okay.
How big a field of antennas to receive the energy?
Typically about a square mile at maximum.
That's not so bad. That's really not so bad.
And keep in mind that you can have numerous receivers fed from the same power station because you can send multiple beams all over the place.
Right. This would all be doable in what span of time, Sir Charles?
7 years or less. As soon as you get somebody to support you economically in a project like this, you're off and running.
If it is, as you say, economically and technically feasible, the obvious question is, then why isn't somebody doing it now?
Well, you know, we talked about the fact that launch costs are very expensive.
Yes.
G. Myers Group is working on cutting that way down, and he has been working very closely with a number of investors groups from insurance companies and states as well.
Now, once again, here is Sir Charles, and again, I don't mean to co-opt this interview into energy, but I'm telling you, my friends and I on shortwave and people everywhere are talking about the price of gasoline. It's leading a lot of the news stories. The barrel of oil keeps going up every day. It's getting a little frightening. And you're saying that economically, technically, this idea of putting a power collector in space is viable. Now, we all know the launch costs are high, and I want to ask you about something that when I heard about it, I laughed, and a lot of people did, this space elevator thing, the idea of creating an elevator into space, into a geosynchronous point, which is, 22,300 miles up. It seems laughable, but I guess it's not.
Well, actually, the materials are now being made and experimented with that will make it all possible. Basically, it's a new type of carbon called nanofibers or nanotubes, and this material is so strong that a length of it that was not tapered, just like a standard rope, a length of it 3,400 kilometers long could support its own weight. To give you a comparison, if you had a sisal fiber rope, which is standard rope, it could support a length of itself about 6 kilometers long. And polyethylene rope, the plastic, could support about 18 kilometers of itself. This stuff can support 3,400 kilometers.
My God.
It's stronger than diamond. Yes, the fibers have been successfully manufactured, and it looks like they have a process for making them in bulk. And that would be fantastic. And this means that we can build a cable strong enough to support its own weight all the way from orbital space down to the ground.
Huh. This sounds like Jack and the Beanstalk. How would you begin building this monstrosity? Would you start from the ground going up?
Actually, you'd start from orbit because you put a factory or a manufacturing facility and an assembly plant up in orbit, and then you would start building the cable and extending it toward the ground. And if you just manufactured 4 or 5 kilometers a day, well, in no time at all, the thing would be scraping on the ground. And then you'd anchor it down, and you'd send up your first cable car.
It seems, what would hold it, just the strength, what would hold it up?
Actually, it's much simpler than people might imagine. It's actually in orbit. So the hub of this whole assembly is in orbit, just as any satellite would be. And if we place it in orbit above the equator at the geostationary point.
Yes.
And that is, as you said, 22,300 miles up, then it would not move with relation to the ground.
Right.
And so as you start extending the cable, one length of cable would go downward toward the Earth, another length would go outward holding a counterweight.
Ah.
And so between the two, the tensions would remain equal, and it would not move.
A counterweight in space. But in space... things don't have weight as we understand it. So you're just talking mass?
That's correct, just the mass. And as the system is designed now, they might not even need that because there will be enough mass in the taper of the cable. You see, the cable, if it were uniform in strength and uniform in size, would reach a point where you couldn't have any more length or it would snap. So in order to fix that, at the top, you make it broader so that it has the ability to support more of itself.
So one day, we would just look up and we'd see this little dark strand of something headed toward Earth. Well, I suppose we wouldn't because it would have to be at the equator, right?
Well, you'd be able to see it from a long way off.
Sure. I bet you would.
But you probably would see it as being a light color unless something was changed in the technology. They plan on coating it with a thin layer of metal so that oxygen erosion will not eat the cable. And they're talking about the ability to lift 20 tons at a time.
And atmospheric troubles like hurricanes and things like that would, I mean, I'm trying to think this through, where there might be a hole in this idea.
Well, consider that this cable, like a guitar string, would have a resonant frequency. But its resonant frequency would be about 7.2 hours. So
Say it again. 7.2 what?
Hours.
Hours?
Yes. If you plucked it like a string, the vibrations would take over 7 hours to work it back and forth once.
Oh, I see. Wow.
So because of its resonant frequency, we shouldn't have any problem with hurricanes or storms.
Huh. They would just whiz by it and it simply wouldn't be affected.
That's correct.
Can you give me an idea of how, actually, for example, by the time it got to Earth, how big would this cable, as you call it, be?
It would be about a meter wide and flat, flat like a sheet of paper.
Really?
That's correct. And that way you can grab it with a pair of rollers and run up and down it, and you have a lot more surface tension or surface area to contact it, so you can't slip.
That's incredible. So you'd be able to virtually ride this thing right up out of the Earth's atmosphere slowly with no friction, not having to achieve... Well, wouldn't there be... I'm a dummy in this area, and I know that rockets have to, you know, get tremendous power and tremendous speed to get away from Earth.
Okay, I see where you're going with that. Actually, if you're not orbiting the Earth in a rocket, if you were to stand stationary over the Earth, you'd find that you'd still fall toward the ground, but the force of gravity gets weaker as you leave the surface.
Right.
So as you go up the cable, you don't have to worry about orbital motion because you're suspended on a solid object.
I've got that, but something still has to power this thing, right?
No, that's correct. You'd beam power up to it either through microwaves or laser beams.
Huh. And I wonder what kind of journey we're talking about here. If you were to get into an elevator attached to this thing at the bottom and start up, how long would it take you to get there?
Well, if you went to the geostationary point where the main station would be, it would take about 8 hours.
8 hours?
Quite a while.
That's quite unreal
than an airline flight, you know?
Well, unreal in a lot of ways. If something like that existed, I suppose then that the solar station you talk about and resupply and all the rest of it working on it would all be a piece of cake.
That's right, because once you had the first skyhook or space elevator in place, you'd use it as the facility to build two or three more, and then you'd have some that ride up with cargo and some that come down with cargo, and you'd have a continuous flow of passengers and hardware. And this would cut your launch costs from... Let's see, the recent estimate was $20,000 per kilogram, down to eventually about $10 per kilogram.
Is this idea, for example, reasonable? Are they actually approaching the viability of these materials in that kind of mass?
Well, it looks like they are. They have
really
discovered a manner of getting the nanofibers to assemble themselves. And it turns out as simple as dragging a post-it note over the material as it was grown on a substrate, and the fibers self-assemble.
Wow.
But the other thing is, and this is a technological spin-off, the first batch of the material they produced appears to be transparent, and it looks like they may be able to turn it into a new type of display. There are talks about the same material being used to make flat televisions or displays that can be rolled up or folded.
Really?
Yes.
So we've really come a very long way in a very short time. I had no idea some of this could actually be just about viable. All right. I thank you for all of that. I mean, these are questions I really wanted answered. Mars. Now, I know for some reason, with your background, you suddenly took a gigantic interest in Mars. Why?
It's just been such an interesting place, and there were so many things I learned as a kid about the solar system that just kept me wanting to learn. And in technology, particularly in aerospace and in science, the more things you learn, the more tools you have in your arsenal to solve problems with. And it just sort of naturally was an outgrowth for me. Being in aerospace, everything you learn about space in general tends to have a relationship to what you're doing. So Mars has always been a fascinating place to me.
All right. Skipping to the chase, you know, you have looked at Mars really hard. What would be the headline that you would write about what you found on Mars?
That Mars is a fossil planet, and life was common throughout both Mars and Earth at the same times. But not only that, we now know where the water is. And that's the big thing right now.
Why is there water at all on Mars?
Because all the planets in our solar system were formed out of the same material and at the same time, and their chemistries were similar. And the gases known as ammonia and methane, and of course water vapor, were trapped inside the molten material that the planets were made of. So water is in the mix underground. It's a product of ammonia and methane being broken down in molten rock. It gets cooked into water and petroleum, carbon dioxide, and nitrogen. So our oceans, our petroleum, and our atmospheres all come from that same source.
Are we to imagine that at one time on Mars there were oceans, much as there are here on Earth now?
Indeed. It looks as if the whole planet were covered by water at some point.
The whole planet.
It must have undergone ice ages as well as our world. And so at this point, the areas that the two rovers are looking at presently, Gusev Crater and Meridiani Planum, were both estimated to be at least a meter deep in water. They're about the same elevation. And Mars doesn't have its continents moving around. There's no tectonic activity. So we know the altitudes of those areas must have remained constant for many millions of years, possibly billions. So the sedimentary rocks, and they have admitted there are sedimentary rocks, were formed by water. So minerals were being eroded in the weather and deposited in this water. And now as you look at those areas, you see all of these huge polygons and all these spherules. The water was lost because of its weaker gravity and thin atmosphere, but there's still water underground, and there's still water
in ice. If there was at once water on Mars, then something must have changed. You said its gravity, its atmosphere. At one time, they were sufficient to hold the water, so what happened?
Well, we both started out, Earth, Mars, and in fact Venus as well, started out with very thick atmospheres. Venus still has a great deal of it. Earth had an atmosphere about 250 times as dense as the atmosphere we have today, and its gravity wasn't sufficient to hold it, and it bled off, fortunately, over the many billions of years. Mars started with roughly the same amount of atmosphere by all accounts that we can tell from the chemistry and the materials it was from,
yes.
But because its atmosphere was held by its gravity much less strongly, it was lost to space, and when the atmosphere goes, the water starts to go.
So it slowly leaked out.
That's right. It all leaked away because Mars only has about one-third of the gravity, 38% of the gravity the Earth has.
By the way, skipping backward for one second, I've received, I don't know, a lot of emails from people, and first they've seemed laughable, Sir Charles, but they said, you know, every time we launch a spacecraft, we lose something. I mean, it's like, you know, bursting through a balloon or something temporarily, and we lose a little of our own atmosphere or lose something or another. I get these emails. There is some truth to that, isn't there?
Well, there's a little bit of material loss, but it is absolutely minuscule. There's material falling to Earth just as well. But our atmosphere is being replenished, and this is a very interesting thing that you brought this up, and this is very interesting for people to know. Volcanoes replenish our atmosphere and our water. Did you know that the material that comes out of volcanoes is average about 70% water?
No, I didn't know that.
Yes, in fact, some volcanoes have as much as 97% water coming out of its exhaust. Huh. Omotombo has 97.1% as measured in 1994. Kilauea in Hawaii puts out about 37.1% water in its eruptions. This is why lava often explodes. It's loaded with water, and this water is flashed to steam when the pressure is released from the lava, and it explodes.
And there's no volcanoes on Mars, right?
Well, there are some volcanoes. They're very large volcanoes. In fact, the largest volcano known in the solar system, Olympus Mons, is on Mars. Unfortunately, it appears that there's very little or no volcanic activity on Mars at this time because the planet lost a lot of its heat. The Earth has a very large core and a lot of material in it stays hot because of radioactive meltdown. Uh-huh. Mars's core is smaller and therefore has less of this material in it to keep it hot, and it's apparently just about worn out.
So is it fair to say Mars is a dead planet?
Not entirely. You see, recently they discovered what appears to be a frozen sea on the equator of Mars, big glaciers of ice. And they say that it was formed roughly 5 million years ago in what appears to have been a volcanic episode.
Okay. Why should we be interested in Mars, Sir Charles?
Is an excellent question.
Okay.
Let me tell you a story about an ice cap. For 40 years, this northern ice cap has been melting. It's melting away, and there's no question about it. Over 10,000 measurements have been made with CCD instruments like cameras. But this ice cap is not melting because of SUVs or exhaust or oil companies or industry.
Uh-huh.
And the reason they know that is because it is Mars' north polar cap that is melting. So somehow, both Earth and Mars appear to be undergoing a phase of global warming simultaneously.
That's very interesting. I did see a story on global warming on Mars, and apparently it's moving at a faster rate than it is here on Earth.
And that indicates that it has to have a common source, most likely, and that would be the sun.
That would indeed be the sun.
And the report was made by the Astronomical League at the Alcon Expo 2005. They had a conference in Kansas City just last week.
Okay, maybe you'd like to, I mean, clearly, I've felt for some time that our climate is in the midst of a very quick change. But by our standards, I mean, human beings, I think, are not supposed to see changes in the climate. They occur over millions of years, and yet a lot of people are beginning to notice a real change in climate. Do you believe there's justification in that?
Well, yes. You know, we haven't kept good records over the last 2,000 or 4,000 years, so it would be difficult for us to say with great precision just how much change there was. But think about the case of Greenland.
Or Alaska.
Yes. Greenland wasn't named Greenland just because somebody was thinking wishfully. It was actually green just 1,000 years ago.
Senator McCain just came back, I guess, from Alaska, and he virtually said the place is melting. And those Alaskans I've talked to verify that the tundra is turning to mush.
And it doesn't surprise me.
Parts of the state.
It looks like very much that these sorts of changes might be natural, and there's very little that we can do about it directly.
You believe that? Okay. Our North Pole, our South Pole, when you see 10-year photographs of them, it's frightening. The North Pole is, perhaps two-thirds or less what it was 10 years ago or 40 years ago. I don't know. It's fast.
Well, that's true. We don't have anything to compare it to, typically, but yes, it appears to be happening in just a matter of decades.
Our Navy.
And it may be in part what we're doing, but it appears that there's also a link to Mars itself.
A link to Mars. Is what, the sun?
The sun itself, yes. It drives all of our weather. In fact, it drives the weather throughout our solar system.
Then, like gas prices, do you think it's just going to keep getting hotter and hotter and hotter?
Well, no, I don't. And I think that what's going to happen is it's going to have to bottom out at some point and then reverse.
The gas or the sun? The gas or the sun or both?
Well, the sun, typically. Gas, we're going to have to do something about. We have to take some action on that.
Once again, Sir Charles Schultz III with a small prediction, Sir Charles.
Well, certainly. You know, I've been looking at the situation with petroleum and China and India, this whole energy picture.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that China and India, between them, have invested or promised to invest over the next 30 years a total of $150 billion in the development of new petroleum resources, and that's from drilling into the ground, processing, pumping, running to the sea, and shipping it home. Now, half of the world's oil supply resides in Alberta, Canada, of all places, and it's in the form, unfortunately, of tar sands.
There's
1.3 trillion barrels there. So
yes.
It's been uneconomical up to now to do anything with it.
Is it now?
Oh, now it is economical. And here's my prediction. I'm going to predict that China will attempt to buy into the Alberta tar sands.
Oh, really? And and you're saying now at the price we've for a barrel of oil, it's now economical to convert this into petroleum.
It certainly is. So that's a small prediction, but I think it's going to have a big impact.
Well, I knew as the price went up, all of a sudden, all sorts of things that were not particularly interesting, you know, a dollar or two ago for gas now are. And will continue to be as it goes up. I don't know where the breakpoint is, but one of these wonderful things has got to come along before the American economy just, you know, grinds to a halt.
Well, I think a lot of people don't realize that the price of gasoline or the price of oil affects everything in the economy because you have to pay for shipping to get things places, and that takes diesel fuel.
Yes.
You know, energy to manufacture things.
So the price to extract this and then turn it into something usable is now suddenly is worth doing.
It's in reach. It's in reach now.
It's in reach.
And it will happen.
You think the Canadians will go along with this?
It's going to depend on where they feel morally they should accept the money from. If they just want the money, then a business deal is a business deal.
I've heard rumors, Sir Charles, that the environment in China right now, maybe you can confirm this, is much like it was during the 70s oil shortage in the U.S., and that was a pretty severe climate. Is it that bad in China now?
From what I understand, yes, it is, and there are desperate needs of sources of energy because they are a huge economic growth point at this time in history. They're their biggest burst of growth they've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And also, look at this from another standpoint. It looks like the Chinese are going to have somebody on the moon in just a very few years. Perhaps this is the sort of thing we need to get our government to get moving on space travel.
Why do you think the Chinese want to get to the moon?
Well, I think they understand the value of space in terms of energy and resources. And I believe...
Helium-3?
If I'm not mistaken, they're going to want to develop it.
Well, helium-3? Or why else go to the moon?
Possibly helium-3, but think about all the minerals that nobody claims. They're right on the surface for anyone who wishes to mine them. But it also could be a national prestige issue as well. If you develop the technology to get a spaceship to the moon with people in it safely and return them to Earth...
Mm-hmm.
You also have developed a lot of other technologies that other countries will not sell you.
I guess it is not proven to the American people nor the lawmakers that allocate the money for this sort of thing because we don't seem inclined to go back to the moon, do we?
At this point, there's only been talk about it. I haven't seen any really decent commitment to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. We seem to do a lot of planning and generate tons of paper, but get very little done sometimes.
Uh-huh. Well, if there was really a good reason other than to beat the other guy to get to the moon, it seems to me we'd be going.
Well, and, you know, it always is going to depend on if we start building power stations, the moon would be the best place for the materials because it would be things we wouldn't have to launch from Earth. It's economically feasible right now to make most of the power station in the form of mirrors and generators and heat exchangers from lunar materials than
right.
to ship it up from the planet.
Well, let's talk about NASA a little bit, shall we? I'd be quite interested, I think, in your perspective now on NASA. I know that you began as something of an innocent with NASA, certainly with some of the discoveries that you've made on Mars, and I'm sure that you've had some discussions and interaction with NASA, and I wonder how you feel about NASA now as an agency.
You know, that's a prickly question.
Yes, I ask those.
Well, that's fine, you know, that's what I'm here for. And, you know, when I look at it, I realize that most of the people who work with NASA are just like anybody else. They're just in there doing their job to the best of their abilities. But clearly, whoever's in charge of the flow of information really doesn't want to share. They tend to be very tight-lipped about things, and it's things that you don't imagine would have any direct influence. I don't understand why anybody would be unhappy about revealing the fact that there are fossils on Mars. And I know you've seen them, and many other people have seen them, and I
Yes.
talk to people in NASA and the Jet Propulsion Lab quite often, and every one of them has given me at least some confirmation that my findings are correct, and some have said, yes, what you found is exactly right.
Well, incidentally, I think that we have some examples of some of your recent finds on the website, don't we?
That's correct. And in fact, if you have a look at it, there's a little sea biscuit. It's similar to a sand dollar, but thicker. And it has a perfect little starfish pattern on the top of it. And that was found by opportunity on Sol 507. And, you know, you came to mind when I spotted that one. And so I've named it because, as you know, if you discover a new species or organism, the discoverer has the right of naming it. Mm-hmm. And so I'm naming it Aria fabrica campana. And the reason for that is fabrica campana is as close as I can get in Latin to Art Bell.
Oh, God, really?
So there's an organism being named after you. And that's
an organism. I'm honored. Is that me in the middle of that rock up there?
it's got that little starfish pattern. I knew that you would recognize it right away. I thought that that'd be something interesting.
A little stick me. Okay. Well, all right. So you have concluded basically that there was, or is, but was, at least was, life on Mars.
That's correct.
And in discussing this with NASA, you feel something of a reluctance to publicly jump on board that ship. Is that correct?
Well, that's correct. Not one placed official that could make any official statements for NASA has come forward and said, yes, there were fossils on Mars or there was life on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, at this point, we have just an overwhelming amount of data, and it doesn't take a great deal of searching to find things like that organism I just mentioned that's got a five-pointed star on it. And as anyone who knows anything about minerals or crystals or erosion and biology would tell you, a five-pointed star that is regular like that doesn't form in nature unless it's formed by biological means.
And why do you think NASA doesn't want this endorsed?
I'm not certain if it really would be in keeping with what they want to do. Some people have expressed to me that if it was discovered that there was life on Mars,
yes,
that they would lose funding for the presently planned exploratory mission.
Why?
Because then people would say, well, you know, you've answered that question. There's no reason to spend $500 million on this satellite that you're going to send there because we know the answer now. But I don't really see it that way. Economics and politics make very strange decisions about what we should and shouldn't do, and I think this is right there. And the other one is the religious standpoint. Many people who are strongly religious have a problem with accepting life anywhere other than on Earth.
Bingo. Now I think you've hit it. That may very well be the case. So you think NASA, in deference to the world's religions, might not be wanting to confirm that there is life somewhere other than Earth, period?
And that may very well be the case, yes. And to me, that's the only thing that I can think of that even comes near a rational explanation. If I was interested in attending a conference in October by the Logos Institute, and at that conference, it was going to be in Bellingham, Washington, they were going to discuss different viewpoints about life in the universe and the religious take on it in particular. And so I was asked if I was interested in participating, and I said, yes, I'd love to, you know. And the fellow that I spoke with has actually been a guest on your show before, Dr. Michael Heiser.
Oh, yes.
And so, I accepted immediately. And then later I found out just a couple of days back that the organizer, Rob Haskell, had not put me on the roster. He dropped me from the lineup.
Oh.
Well, you know, that's unusual because I would think that I would be uniquely suited to speak about life on Mars.
One would certainly think so, yes. I mean, you've produced actual solid evidence that there certainly was life on Mars. I certainly see it that way. Now there are others with other theories. Richard C. Hoagland is one of them. And he thinks that there is some great darker matter to all of this, that NASA's well aware of not only life on Mars, but the fact that at one time there was intelligent life on Mars. Have you locked out that one, or do you wonder about it?
I don't believe that intelligence arose on Mars, and this is a point that I try to make very clear. The life that existed on Mars seemed to be pretty primitive sea life, nothing truly advanced. If there was ever intelligent life on Mars, it would have had to have come from some other world, not from Mars itself.
Well, that, of course, is also possible.
And that's true. That's a very good possibility that now that we know there's life on Mars as well as on the Earth, or was at least, we're certain of that, it would tell you that there should be life throughout our universe, and there could be billions of worlds with life. And, you know, intelligence is another question. We don't know how common intelligence is. We've only got, you know, the examples of humanity on Earth and some other near misses in the terms of other animals, such as chimpanzees and dolphins. But intelligence on other planets is another question entirely. We don't see any signs of that yet.
Well, we don't. I mean, we've got SETI, and some of the SETI officials will frankly tell you if in another, you know, at least 50 years, and I think it could be sooner than that, they don't find something, then, you know, there's a legitimate question there about whether there is something.
Well, you know, that's another interesting point, too. Notice that as we have moved from analog to digital technology, what we transmit by radio has changed very dramatically. In many cases, if you pick up a radio signal, and it could be voice or data or anything, you can't decode it without a certain specific key or a frame.
That's right, yes.
Now, it has been suggested that up to one quarter of the radio noise we receive from the sky could in fact be mixed digital signals from all over. And we just, without the key, would be unable to decode it.
And we just don't have the key yet.
So we could be bathed in alien signals and not be aware of it because we don't have the key to decode it or the framing.
Is that a current pursuit of SETI? I mean, that's such a fascinating concept that it really is all around us, and we simply have not provided the encryption key yet to unlock it. That's such a fascinating idea.
And it isn't a pursuit of SETI because they concentrate on a specific set of frequencies very near the water hole.
Yes.
Their term for it.
Yes.
And so we don't broadcast on that frequency or that set of frequencies, and to assume that other intelligences would, I mean, why do we make that assumption? They would be broadcasting all over the band just as we do.
Spread spectrum.
That's right.
And with spread spectrum, folks, means that a frequency is hopping around at what would seem like a random rate, making it totally impossible to track the signal and therefore extract any intelligence from it. And Sir Charles is talking about the fact that actually the signals could be, and it could be, all around us right now, and we simply don't have the key. Wouldn't that be a reasonable pursuit for some of the computers at SETI?
Well, it could. And Fourier analysis, which is a special type of mathematical analysis dealing with frequencies and time and energy, might be able to tell us whether or not this is the case. But understand that they're only looking at a very narrow band of frequencies and not at these other signals. But we've got a disadvantage as well. Our environment around us is very, very noisy. So it would be next to impossible to sort out what was being generated by our machinery and technology versus what was actually coming from space.
Well, it would be nice to know somebody's going to go to work on that because it sounds so logical. I'm going to have to give that one some serious thought. Have you been contacted at all, Sir Charles, by anybody within the government? Forget NASA for a moment, but any other area of the government?
Well, it's good you ask that. I have not been directly connected, but my website, as you know, most websites do record the types of visitors and how often.
Yes.
And I get some regular visitors that would probably astound people to know about. Any given day, I get somewhere between 5 and 40% of government and military hits on my site.
No kidding.
Between 5 and 40%. Some of the regulars, and I wasn't going to name names, but I think I'm going to do that now.
Yeah.
Some of the regulars who visit my site are Lockheed Martin Corporation, Boeing, Lear, Virgin, NASA, JPL, Orbital Sciences, Rocketdyne, and Vandenberg Air Force Base, for instance.
My goodness.
I get regular hits from the Department of Defense, and not just in this country, from Canada, the Department of National Defense, D&D, and the Australian Department of Defense, the Department of Defense Information Systems Center, the National Security Agency, Foreign Technologies Division, Army, Air Force, Navy, Defense Mapping Agencies, Naval Warfare Centers,
good
Army
God.
Special Ops Commands.
That's almost the whole group. I mean, you could go on and on, but that's all government. My gosh.
Oh, that's just the tip of the iceberg.
And why do you think they're there, Sir Charles?
Well, I can see what pages they're looking at, and that's interesting, because they're downloading, in particular, the organisms. They're making copies of the organisms.
They're making
the Centers for Disease Control, the Mayo Clinic, Johns Hopkins, and the National Institute of Health. Each spent roughly a week on my page looking at every single organism that I had posted on my site.
I'll be damned.
But now there's an interesting byproduct of this. We had some hits from Berkeley, after which Dr. Seth Shostak, the chief administrator of SETI, published an article warning of the dangers of a Mars sample return. The Mars sample return mission has been pushed back to 2011.
As the obvious point being that organisms might still be there, and do we really wish to bring them back to planet Earth? And then there's also an interesting reverse of that, Sir Charles. I've heard that a number of the probes, the early probes that we sent to Mars, we didn't spend a great deal of contamination time, decontamination time on them, and in fact, we might have contaminated Mars.
And that's a very good possibility. It could have happened.
How true is that, that the early spacecraft weren't all that spiffy in terms of having been boiled and whatever?
Well, you know, whenever you try to sterilize an organism, you also subject the hardware to the same sort of conditions that can destroy electronics and sensors.
Mm.
And so they have to be very careful about how they go about the sterilization business. Early spacecraft typically weren't sterilized very well. And it wasn't just a budgetary matter, but it was also a rather, you know, Earth-centric belief that there really wasn't life anywhere, and there was no risk.
Huh.
So we've got a lot of dirty hardware floating around out there.
And presumably then, organisms generated by technicians' hands and all the rest of it could now be racing around Mars.
And that's a good possibility. If any of them find themselves at home in briny, wet soil, they would love it there.
Huh. So if we bring back a sample from Mars, unless that gets scrubbed as perhaps a bad idea, we might find ourselves.
And that's possible, but there would be an easy way to know if that were true.
How so?
Our genetic code is probably very different from a Martian genetic code or an alien genetic code. And so if we spot something that has a known sequence of genes, then we're going to know it was an earthly organism.
Huh.
It's like a fingerprint.
I see. Would Mars support the spread of an organism that came from Earth?
Well, it could. It really depends on the type of organism. They've discovered a number of soil bacteria that could probably thrive, and we know that there are many bacteria called extreme halophiles.
I'm so curious, Sir Charles. What do you think all these agencies really want? I mean, they're working, these agencies have, you know, the same NASA photographs available to them. Presumably they know all this stuff already. Why?
I think that it's in the presentation of the data. You know, the fact is, a lot of the stuff is very difficult for people to spot without looking through masses of data.
Mm.
And on my site, well, we spent a great deal of time finding the most obvious fossils and presenting them and the information about them in a very concise manner, and you can find everything right there. If you go to the NASA site, all the information's there, but you can't find it. Think about an encyclopedia and the index required for it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same way.
Of course, there's probably no way for you to know the level of the people that are coming in, but of course we have a lot of government workers, and a lot of them do work for different agencies. You don't have any way of knowing how high up the food chain it's been going, do you?
No, I don't, but we had a number of interesting hits just a couple of days ago from the Justice Department, and they were looking it over, the State Department as well.
Really?
Yes, and you know, it's interesting because the State Department has been looking at whether technology transfer would be involved in, let's say, the orbital power concepts.
Huh.
And different parts of the government are probably looking at some of this information and some of the other things that I'm doing, and it's all public knowledge. And I don't know exactly what they're putting together, but obviously everything they need, they can find right there. I mean, the fossils are there. The information on what I'm working on is there. And I hope they find everything they want. And I hope even more clearly, and I'm telling them, call me. I'll tell you anything you want to know.
A little chuckle in your voice.
And the water issue, I didn't want to sidestep that.
Yes.
I wanted to tell you just how important that is. You know, we've been told for years that Mars is dry.
Mm-hmm.
And on the links that I gave you for the site, there is a picture of a crater that they found on Mars, and it's about 70 degrees north latitude near the North Pole.
Yes.
And it has apparently 2 cubic miles of water ice inside it.
That's a lot.
That's just in one crater. That's enough to give every man, woman, and child on Earth over 300 gallons of water.
Now, obviously, water is important for fuel. Water is important for sustenance. If we were to send people to Mars, the water would sustain them, correct?
That's correct, yes.
The water could then separate to hydrogen and make fuel.
And oxygen to breathe.
And oxygen to breathe, yes. And all of that it could be done now. I mean, of course, we're not going to Mars. We're barely going back to the moon. I'm not so sure about that.
That's true. But I think what is most important is what it implies. You see, if there's water present in those quantities now, then obviously there should still be something alive. The planet was never dry. But the interesting thing is, there appears to be some form of precipitation now, and that's backed up by pictures of the rover's tracks.
Precipitation?
So, yes, and it may be spray from a geyser, and it may be actual a fog of water droplets. The rovers leave tracks, and we're told that the erosion on Mars is very slow. I think it was Dr. Stephen Squires, the principal investigator for the Mir project, who said, we found some craters 4 to 6 inches in diameter, and they could be up to 100 million years old. Well, these little potholes are on the sides of sand dunes, and when you consider there are dust storms and sandstorms and dust devils, it doesn't seem even possibly or remotely possible that a pothole 4 inches across could last 100 million years. But now we know that it's impossible. When the rover Opportunity was stuck in that dune for a while, it left its tracks behind it, and then they backed out over the tracks later.
Right.
They turned the cameras and the microscopic imager on those tracks. Now, instead of being clean and sharp and pristine as they were eroded, and they were eroded into the pattern identical to that that raindrops make in sand. And this happened over the space of 1 to 2 weeks. But more important, if you've ever seen rocks on a sand pile, when the rain falls, the rocks are left on pillars of sand.
Right.
They stand upright. I have the microscopic image that shows the spherules standing on the sand in the track that was absolutely flat and ridged by the rover's wheels.
Are you trying to suggest it rains on Mars?
I don't know if it was rain, but I do know that there are active geysers. It may well have been spray from a geyser. But whatever it is, there's water precipitating on the surface on a basis of a week or less. And that's proven by the age of the tracks, which is known.
Okay. All right. Why should we be interested in Mars again? What possible reason could we have for going to Mars, expensive as it would be? What would we gain?
Well, for one thing, there is a great deal of material available on Mars in the forms of metals and chemicals and minerals that we cannot easily get to in those quantities on the Earth. So industrial development and living space would be very easy to manufacture on Mars using the available materials. Another is it provides a whole biological laboratory for us to study the development of life. And this is a very important question. Where do we come from? Who are we? Where are we going? You know, what is life in the universe like? And how common is it? And we could discover a lot of that just from looking at Mars. And, of course, the climate issue, as we discussed earlier, the global warming points. So there are many things we can learn from Mars. And anytime you have a place where people can go, if it's possible for them to live there, they'll make a frontier of it and they'll move there. This is to be expected. People will be going. And there's some support from the government, actually, in a small form. In a recent discussion between Mike Griffin, the new chief administrator of NASA, and Gene Myers,
yes,
they spoke for a couple of hours on the phone. One of the things that Mike Griffin told him was that they really supported shuttle-derived launch vehicles, but he also admitted that he and the president were very keen on turning over the development of low-Earth orbit space to industry and commerce.
Really?
So apparently some wheels are getting moving, and they see that because private individuals and small companies can indeed afford to make workable spacecraft, that maybe it's time to begin turning these things over to the small guy. Now, there's one thing that will help us greatly in space development. Presently, anything that's launched has to have the approval of the government. If you live in this country, the government has to approve whatever you launch.
Right.
And that's because the government takes responsibility for anything you launch, if it were to hit somebody's city or home or something. But what about airliners? We don't do that for airplanes.
No.
If we did, it would be impossible to have air travel. clearly, if you want to have space become a commercial and a viable commercial venture, you have to turn the responsibility for launched vehicles over to the individuals or companies doing the launching. Once you do that, the floodgates will open.
If an airliner crashes on some friendly country's buildings and kills a bunch of people, you're saying our government takes responsibility for that?
No, actually, they do not.
They
don't. Private companies do.
Private companies.
The difference is, if you had a rocket and the same thing happened, our government would hold itself responsible.
Why?
This is, well, I don't know why they do it, but it gives them a measure of control. Unless they actually approve it, you can't launch it.
In what way is it different than an airliner?
And that's my point exactly. It isn't different. It's only perceived to be different.
For what purpose? In other words...
Well, that I couldn't say.
Well...
Not being privy to what they're thinking.
Well, there has to be a reason they don't want private individuals launching without their permission.
Well, one thing to think about is this. If you have the energy necessary to create a sizable spacecraft, all you have to do is aim it at the ground and it becomes a weapon. And so there's a
good
bit of
point.
A paranoia attached to that sort of thinking. The same thing is true for an airliner, as we all know.
Okay, Sir Charles, it's not just the Myers Group. There are others. I'm aware personally, Sir Charles, of some projects underway right now to make cheap launch vehicles, not just the Myers Group, although they're certainly at the top of the heap.
Well, certainly Elon Musk, for one.
Yes, and others. I just won't name them, but they exist, and they're pretty well underway. Do you see these private ventures succeeding, and soon, one of them?
Actually, I do, because it's just as inevitable as development in any field. Just as computers became extremely cheap and commonplace, you're going to see the barnstorming era of spaceflight begin, and we're going to see space transport on a scale we can't even imagine right now.
Barnstorming. I like that.
That's
term.
Correct.
And you really think it'll get to the point where there'll just be all kinds of launches by all kinds of groups?
Well, of that much, you know, you can be certain, because if it's possible to make it fly and make a dollar at it, somebody's going to do it.
Mm-hmm. And you don't believe the government will put the clamps on this for some as yet unconfirmed reason?
Well, if you think about it, other countries are now going to be stepping to the fore in space travel, and they're not going to be doing it just for demonstration. They're after resources, money, and electrical power. And energy is the big thing right now. If, let's say, China were to, or India were to put up a power satellite, how quickly do you think it would polarize us to get something done?
Very quickly.
Yes.
In that arena, very quickly. I don't know if the Chinese go back to the moon, whether that will cause us to sort of enter another race or not. I have my doubts, even if they were to go to Mars. But if they were to do as you just suggested, I think we'd be embarrassed kind of the way, you know, when the Russians put up the first Sputnik and it beeped its way around the world.
Yes, indeed.
So, are they working on it, Sir Charles?
Well, I don't know if they're directly working on orbital power in China, but they do know the concept exists. It has been touted as a solution instead of using hydrocarbon fuels and coal. I know that Condoleezza Rice and her secretary have been to China, India, and Japan, and other nations, in an effort to try and sell them on other technologies besides the petroleum industry or the coal industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, there have been no takers. And, you know, you've heard the huge amount of money that China and India are going to be investing in petroleum. You know, $150 billion is a lot of money.
It is indeed. One other area, we're going to go to, you know, the phone lines here in the last hour, but I want to ask you about, you and I have talked before about artificial intelligence and about robots and about robots even going to war, for example, in Iraq.
Yes.
Where are we with all of that?
Well, as you'll know, when we spoke last, this was in January, we had talked about the fact that we're sending some robotic fighters to Iraq.
Yes,
and I mentioned unmanned autonomous vehicles, particularly aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
The cover story of the July Popular Science was exactly that. I know of at least six unmanned autonomous vehicles that are under development or actual testing that will be used very shortly in warfare. For instance, they have one called the DP-5X, and it's an 11-foot-long helicopter, and it is unmanned, and it has about a 5.5-hour endurance in flight.
Does it carry?
And it fits in the back of a Humvee.
And it carries weapons?
It's mostly sensors and recon hardware right now, and it can also be used as a communications relay, like a satellite. You hover it over a point, and you use it to relay your communications around. I don't see why it couldn't carry weapons. They have another one called Long Gun. It's about a 12-foot-long craft, and it's an automated missile. This one you'll like. It has about 30 hours of flight time. You send it out after targets, and it locates the targets using infrared and other parts of the spectrum, and it decides on whether it's a target it should hit.
Mm-hmm.
If it finds a target, it will hit it automatically.
You're saying
if it doesn't,
it makes these decisions on targeting
right.
on its
yeah.
own.
But here's the interesting part. If it doesn't find a target,
yes.
it can be ordered to return to base. It can be refueled and flown again.
My goodness.
And that's just two of a number. One of them
and are we using these now?
Some small of the vehicles, some of the smaller models are in test right now. As to whether they're in the field or not, I know that there are some autonomous vehicles in the field, but I don't know how effective they are at this point.
Uh-huh.
But they even have one in development that'll fit in a backpack, and it's like a hover platform, so that the soldiers can carry it out, throw the thing out in the field, and take off with a video camera or whatever. Fits in their backpack.
Are we headed toward a world where machines will do our warfare?
We certainly are, yes. We're to the point now where we've got hardware in development that could very easily, if not automatically perform warfare functions. We could simply operate a lot of it by remote control. So, yes, we are headed for automated warfare.
You know, there are, maybe there ought not be ethical questions about this, but there are ethical questions about it, whether it's ethical to use just machines to kill your enemy. And I don't think I have any compunction about that. I mean, war is hell, and war is bad, and war is killing, and if you don't have to have your own people die while at the task, I can't find fault with it. Can you?
I'd have to agree with you. If it means that we can save at least some lives, and it gives us an edge in combat, then I'd have to agree with it, yes.
Do you understand the ethical objections some have?
Well, actually, I do. Some people feel that somehow it's worse being killed by a robot than a bomb.
Yeah, or that it's some sort of cowardly warfare. I don't know.
Yes. You know, I don't know if you have an objection to fighting and you're forced to fight and you do it because you must. Are you a coward if you try not to fight? If you try to cover yourself or defend yourself in a better manner?
I don't know. We've come a long way from the days
difficult.
Where the British stood in very nice, neat lines and marched toward the enemy.
And they learned a lesson there, very valuable.
And they did indeed. anyway, the world of robotics is beginning to come true, right?
In fact, it is, and we're going to see more and more of it around us every day. Battlefield is the first.
Do you imagine that right now, Sir Charles, we have orbiting weapons?
We've touched on this subject before.
Mm-hmm.
I can see a few systems that could be considered weapon. I cannot specifically say if we do have weapons in orbit.
Mm-hmm.
I know of some systems that could easily be considered weapons.
Let's try another approach. Do you think that any country in the world has orbiting weapons?
Well, I suspect that some do. And we have to face the inevitability of warfare in space. If we start space travel and we start using weapons in space because of something, it doesn't matter what it is, we run some serious risks. And we know there's going to be fighting. It always happens. Wherever there's human beings, you will have warfare.
Sure.
But if we use those weapons in space, we run into some real problems. For instance, debris. On the ground, when you explode a bomb or hit a target, the debris ends up on the ground or in the atmosphere. If you do that in space, the debris ends up in orbit.
Hmm.
And the problem is you can contaminate a pristine environment. So a spacecraft or a satellite being hit by some of this debris can be destroyed. A paint flake moving at orbital velocities can carry the energy of a hand grenade.
So by exploding something or destroying something, we could be creating projectiles that would destroy our own spacecraft.
That's correct. Do you remember the super gun that Saddam Hussein was working on years ago?
I certainly do.
Oh, yes. Well, one of the projections they made was that if he shot out of the gun a small rocket motor, it could carry a small payload into orbit.
No kidding.
And if he were to put a sack of BBs in that payload and fire it in the opposite direction that satellites orbit, let's say the geosynchronous orbit,
right,
that sack of BBs could spread out and destroy many of the satellites in that orbit and make it uninhabitable for satellites for thousands of years.
My God.
That was
God.
A serious concern.
Despite some very dire predictions that were made, thank God the space shuttle returned to Earth safely recently, as you all recall. However, there was, while they were up there, much consternation about this damage or that damage, and frankly it seemed like they spent the better part of the mission worrying, justifiably so, I guess, about the damage that might or might not have been done to the spacecraft on launch and the safety of a return. They really did spend a hell of a lot of time on that. And I wanted you to comment, Sir Charles, these space shuttles seems like it's nearing the end of its life. It really does, one way or the other, grounded yet again, I guess, and, you know, old. We don't see a replacement for it in the wind. And,
it should be retired. It's a 30-year-old system.
Yes, but fine. But what about its replacement?
Well, as you know, the Space Island Group has a design for a vehicle that would replace the shuttle easily, and most of the components will be directly from the shuttle manufacturing facilities with minor modifications.
But you're
suggesting
it's not going to be the government that provides the replacement, or NASA.
Well, if we're lucky, it will be an outside group and not the government, because typically when you get a situation where you have private industry in competition, they'll make it a lot cheaper. I mean, imagine if your family car was made by the government instead of Ford Motor Company or Chevy or whoever.
Is there time, Sir Charles? I mean, we've got the International Space Station under construction. We can't afford to just, hand the shuttle a golden parachute and say goodbye.
Well, there is time, because many systems have already been designed, and even NASA on their own website has a number of vehicles that are derivatives of the shuttle, and their new administrator, Mike Griffin, states he's strongly in support of shuttle-derived vehicles. And the reason for that is those components are knowns. They're manufactured now. There are lines that can be turned on in an instant to start manufacturing them, and they've been tested, so we know that they're reliable. But we need to change the heat shielding, the foam on the tanks. A couple of issues can be resolved that will end any debate about the safety of the system. And if you're sending things up that never come back to Earth, you don't need to worry about the heat shielding on it.
Are you not a fan of man in space? Are you more a fan of machine in space?
Oh, no. I strongly support a manned space effort. But the thing about it is, when you send something as large as a shuttle up, you should be committed to keeping something that big in orbit. The expenditure of getting that much hardware up there is the largest cost of the mission.
Mm-hmm.
If you need to bring things back, it should be human beings in a return capsule or glider and the results of their experiments.
If you had an opportunity other than for the thrill of it, would you feel safe flying in a shuttle?
5 years ago, I would have said, where's my toothbrush? Today, I don't think I would do it.
Really? So it is time, then, in your opinion, to retire the shuttle, even if it means a delay in the space station.
I don't think we're going to see a completion of the space station. And at this point,
really?
Looking at the results of the research done in the station, I really don't see that we're getting our money's worth out of it. There are a lot of experiments you can't do on the space station. In fact, there are many experiments that cannot be done on a manned station at all, because human beings and the machines to keep them alive produce a lot of vibrations, and it's a dirty environment.
All right, I want to take some calls, and they certainly are here. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Sir Charles Schultz. Hi.
Hi, this is Sharon in L.A.
Hello, Sharon.
Hi. Earlier, you stated that it was a fallacy that microwave ovens can bring about negative biological effects, and I have seen many studies for example, showing that microwaves that happened to be leaking at eye level cause eye damage, and they had quite a lot of opportunity to study this in people who worked in fast food places, and they could see where they were standing. And you also stated that the microwave technology that would be beaming down the equivalent of a quarter of what's produced in a microwave oven, excuse me, would not produce any negative biological effects. And I would be interested in what references there are to support that statement.
All right.
Okay. Actually, what I stated was that I'd never seen anybody with a pacemaker die in exposure to a microwave oven. It's true that a leaky oven can have negative biological effects. We know that. It can harm you. But the figure you quoted, one quarter the density of what's in a microwave oven, actually is incorrect. What I quoted was one quarter the density of sunlight. And the microwave oven energy is about 50 times more intense. So what we would be dealing with in the power beam would be 1/200th, or just 0.5% of the power density of a microwave oven, not 1/4.
All right. So her concerns about the effects of microwave on biology?
Yes, there are effects. If you have, I mean, obviously you can cook with microwaves, but once again, it's a matter of power density. And if your microwave is leaking, there are some obvious signs. If you feel, a slight warmth with your hand around the door, man, right away, get yourself a sensor.
Yes,
they're real cheap at many electronics stores.
It's very bad. You're cooking. That heat is cooking you.
That's right. And we certainly would not want to beam that sort of power down to Earth, but the density would be great enough to be damaging. That's the whole point.
Do we, Sir Charles, really know enough about the long-term effects of low dosages of microwave?
Well, you know, the studies that have shown that microwaves in very low doses over a long period of time don't seem to have any effects don't seem to be getting as much airtime as the ones that claim gloom and doom. I mean, that's the same situation with people saying, oh, I live near a power wire.
Yeah.
I'm worried about my animals, you know.
Okay. All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Art, and good morning, Sir Charles.
Good morning.
Art, first, a pleasure. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
And I'm very fascinated by the space-based microwave because I'm kind of mindful of the pharmaceutical companies want to hear about that, in that well people don't need drugs, so there's no impetus for them to proceed. And I'm wondering what kind of an impedance you're finding from industries such as oil as far as developing not only just this, but wind and solar and those kinds of things. And one other thing, Art, if you wouldn't mind repeating the website for the shortwave, I would certainly appreciate that.
Okay, happy to do it. And remember, folks, there may or may not be something there when you go up. I mean, you're listening to shortwave. It's not a commercial broadcast. It's simply shortwave. But it's www.smeter.net. That's S, letter S, M-E-T-E-R.net. And you'll sort of have a little window into shortwave, the good, the bad, the ugly, all of it. So, Sir Charles, the impedance.
Yes, we don't seem to be having any impediments because right now everybody is feeling the cost of generating power. And people, you know, man on the street, he's going to be very concerned, and already people are very concerned about the cost of petroleum because of what it's doing at the gas pump, for instance. And what is it going to do to our power bills when the winter comes and we have to start heating? I don't see, and I certainly haven't seen, any problems with power companies. Big oil, as you know, depends on the ability to produce petroleum.
Yes.
When the costs get this high, it costs more than a barrel to produce 4 barrels of oil, then they realize they're not going to make as much profit because at some point people are just going to stop paying for it. They're going to choke on it. So it is in everybody's best interest, including oil companies, to begin to diversify.
The profits the oil companies are making right now are rather large, I've heard. At what point do you think the American people will begin to, I don't know, get activist in some manner about the price of the energy?
Well, a lot of people are using public transportation because they just can't afford anything else, but public transportation itself can be problematic. It would be better if we had more and better quality public transportation, and probably less people would drive their vehicles around. And that would be a big dent in the cost of gasoline right there. the less you buy, the less demand there is, the lower the price becomes. Typically. Not always, but typically.
Would you like to make an educated guess as to the sort of the cracking point in economically for us if it keeps going up? Do you predict it will, or do you believe
it? I think it's going to continue to go up, and I'll tell you why. We haven't built another gasoline cracking plant since, I believe, around 1970 or 75. And, you know, that seems rather foolish. We need gasoline. Because of that, we don't have any assurances there will be a larger supply of gasoline, even if there's more oil available. If you can't make the gasoline, then it doesn't do you any good.
Well, I'm just a talk show host, so I don't get it. But if there's all this demand for gasoline, then why not more cracking stations?
I wish I knew.
Could it be the oil companies know something we don't? Ever wonder
about
that?
It's always possible. It's always possible. People always bring the specter of peak oil to mind whenever that question is asked.
That's right.
And perhaps they feel that they're not going to be able to make any more money because there won't be enough oil to support their needs. But that's not necessarily true. As I pointed out, half the oil reserves are right up in Alberta right now in the form of tar sands. And they're going to start processing it because it's now cheap enough to do. It's economically viable. But I think that people are really going to crack when it starts hitting $4 to $5 a gallon.
Yes, yes, and I think the whole economy will crack sometime between 4 and 5 itself. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hi.
Hello, Art. Good morning to you and also your guest, Sir Charles. Earlier in the evening, you were discussing the microwave transmitting solar collector satellite. If I wasn't mistaken, Sir Charles had mentioned the energy that would be transmitted was 23 milliwatts.
That's correct, per square centimeter.
Okay. I thought maybe just coincidental, but 23 milliwatts is also the optimum operating current for the nation's telecommunications network, the landline network. Were you aware of that?
No, that's an interesting coincidence.
Yeah, also we find that at that particular current, it's quite good for recharging a lot of common rechargeable-type batteries and whatnot. Would that be what would go on with this system? It would actually recharge, like, gel packs and stuff like that on Earth?
Well, that's a possibility. All you'd need to do is put some small sort of an antenna that would act like a rectifying antenna or receiver.
Exactly.
And then it could be used to charge batteries. Yes, that can be done. But the largest push is to actually get that electrical power into the grid.
Sir Charles,
baseline electrical.
Sir Charles, out of curiosity, though it seemed like an interesting scheme you talked about to supply, cell phones and small devices, wouldn't it be equally possible and a big problem that this power would be pirated?
Well, yes, it would. but I don't think they're really so much worried about that. It's possible to use a signal that has a specific frequency that's tuned to a specific filter that would be a little difficult for somebody to duplicate, and that could reduce some of the piracy. But yes, somebody's going to figure out how to crack it, and somebody's going to be using it. Hopefully, it'll be cheap enough nobody cares.
That's a good point. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
Good morning. I have a question about microwaves also. Given the fact that there is a supposedly non-lethal weapon, which we are constantly testing, God knows why, using electromagnetic pulse radiation, I would like to ask both of you whether you know for sure whether or not this is being used on any satellites. I know it's been referred to, but in sort of a vague way when I've heard about it. And I'm going to reveal my ignorance in how satellites work by asking whether satellites would always be sort of tuned or set and backed up or working in tandem, so that if the people who are, you know, testing this out on the populace or using it to control the populace or whatever they're doing are shooting down a beam of this, can they have a constant beam, or would it be that it would come around at certain times in a predictable pattern?
Ah, I see. Well, actually, that sort of power would spread out on a small antenna. You need a large antenna, such as you would have on a power satellite, to make a beam that's going to be dense enough and stay together well enough to reach the ground in one piece. If you've shown it out of a satellite with a small antenna, the same thing's going to happen that happens with a flashlight. It'll spread out so much that by the time it reaches the ground, it'll barely be detectable except as a little radio wave signal.
Okay. The commercial satellites that are up there now for television and such have what are called spot beams. And
right.
They really are rather narrow beams that serve a broadcast to a very specific area, for example, Southeast Alaska or something about that size. Is that what you imagine they would do with power? Would they have power spot beams?
Yes, they would, and they put them in parallel. If you imagine that you have one flashlight and you shine it at a distant wall, it spreads out into a very large spot, no matter how you try to focus it, because of the nature of the light waves themselves.
Right.
And microwaves are the same way. They spread out, just like light does. However, even though you can't focus a single one down to a spot, if you had many of them working in concert, shining on the same area, then the average power level would go up to a significant level. So in this case, your beam doesn't seem to spread out. It is spreading out, but they're overlapped so that they reinforce each other.
Okay. What specific effect would this energy have as it traversed the various layers of our atmosphere?
Actually, we can pick frequencies that pass through the air with almost no effect. A very, very tiny amount of heating would occur. I'm on the order of about 0.01 degree centigrade.
Wow. So you're saying harmless. In other words,
we
do have some rather sensitive areas, right, of atmosphere that we're concerned about.
That's true.
The ozone layer, for example. In other words, as it came through these, it would have no measurable effect on them.
That's correct. Well, now it's interesting because somebody has even suggested that by using tuned microwaves or laser beams, we could use them to break down compounds that affect the ozone before they get to that layer.
No kidding.
So there actually could be some benefits to the proper frequencies and energy levels being shown through certain layers of the atmosphere.
So if we wanted to affect the atmosphere with a satellite, we could conceivably do that?
Well, certainly we could.
Oh, that's a horse of a different color, isn't it?
Well, that's true. If you really wanted to change heating effects, yes, you could do it. You'd pick a frequency that the atmosphere would absorb, and then you'd cause local heating. And the interesting thing about that sort of plan is a lot of it would be absorbed by the atmosphere and not reach the ground.
But it would affect the atmosphere.
But it would affect the atmosphere,
conceivably,
yes.
What? Changing climates? Modifying?
You could change a climate, yes. You could select areas and shoot them with specific frequencies and energies of microwave beams, and you could affect the climate in areas, yes.
Thank God our government would never consider such a thing, right?
Oh, of course, they would never consider such a thing.
You know, we laugh, but there are projects underway, ionospheric heaters, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
That I'm sure you're well aware of. Are they dabbling, Sir Charles, in areas they ought not? That's a pretty straight-on question.
Well, that's an interesting question, too. Whether they ought not, that assumes a lot. You want to try things, if you can do so without harming things, to find out how everything works. I mean, we basically study things by picking them apart and poking them and seeing what's inside.
Mm.
When we do experiments in the atmosphere, you do have to be careful. It's just like the first atomic bomb. They didn't know it was going to ignite the atmosphere, you
right.
know, and they did it anyway, and it didn't.
This show this morning really does have an extremely optimistic side to it, and I'm glad to be able to present that because, frankly, what's going on with oil right now in the world is scaring the hell out of me, and I know a lot of you out there as well. I mean, most people, you know, can clearly see where it's headed economically, with what's going on in the world, and I mean China's demand and all the rest of it. So we're either going to find more energy someplace, in a place perhaps like this, or we're in big trouble. Sir Charles, welcome back.
Thank you.
Do you have something, you know, I know you've got a website, so please promote that, and anything else you have, please promote away.
Okay. Well, first off, the book is nearly finished. I now need to locate a publisher, and I'm working on that right away. Second, I wanted to give some thanks to Andy Doan, my new webmaster, who redesigned my site, and I know everybody who sees it appreciates it. Xenotechresearch.com, XENOTECH.com. XENOTECH.RESEARCH. Yes,
could have made it easier, you know.
Yeah, I could have.
So that's Xenotechresearch.com.
Okay.
And
one
we have a link. We have a link, by the way, folks. So.
Oh, very good. And I needed to correct one thing. I said 8 hours for the space elevator to reach the midpoint, the orbital point, geostationary. It would be 8 days. I'm sorry about that.
8 days?
Yes, 8 days.
Well.
It only moves 190 kilometers per hour.
That would require a little provisioning on the way, a couple Hershey bars or something.
It'd be like a cruise.
All right, back to the phones. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sir Charles Schultz III.
Oh, thank you very much, Art. Gary in Santa Maria, KSMA 1240.
Hey, Gary.
Perfect person to ask this question. 20-second setup, maybe 25 at the most.
Sure.
Bin Laden just got religious approval from the clerics to set off a nuclear device. People wonder why it hasn't happened yet. He's a very religious man in that religion, and he wanted approval for the American Hiroshima. Paul Williams says that there's already 20 nuclear weapons planted here. Whether or not you believe they're here, with a border absolutely wide open, and with the recent attacks that they've just discovered in London, 40 million radical Muslims in the world ready to do a kamikaze. That's why we had such a hard time in World War II. When a man is willing to give up his own life to kill you, it's very, very hard to stop. And our border is wide open. Why, under God's green earth, is this president committing this country to an American Hiroshima, whether it be nuclear, biological, or chemical? The red carpet is rolled out, and he keeps saying, well, we're taking the war to them. How... under God's green earth, do you run strictly in offense with no defense and the red carpet rolled out to come say, come take out America?
All right.
Well, that's a heck of a question, and I can tell you this. If I were a politician and I could answer that question, I wouldn't be a scientist.
I would say don't be so concerned about his permission to do this as any story that would indicate that he actually has come into possession of a nuclear weapon. Then I would be very concerned, because there's always going to be somebody willing to extinguish their own life for the cause and set it off. No question about that.
Well, creation is much easier than destruction.
Sir Charles,
I mean, much harder than destruction.
There may be one question you could attempt to answer for me. If there were nuclear weapons in place in the U.S., as some suggest, or there would be one en route to us, do we have sufficient detection equipment in place to know about that?
There is pretty good detection equipment, and you know that it would, and most of it ended up in strategic places where they expect things to come through. Nuclear weapons do have specific signatures, lots of neutrons, for instance.
Right.
And neutron detectors aren't really plentiful right now, but there is a big push to make many more of them. As for the detectors being in place, I would say at this point they probably have a lot more than I'm aware of, and they probably wouldn't say anything about it. Sometimes the stealth that you use in detecting these things is your strongest ally.
Mm-hmm. All right. International line, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hi. When I push the button. Hi there. You're on the air now.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you.
Hello, gentlemen. I have two questions. One is about in reference to the nanotubes technology, and I'm calling from Hanalei in the Pacific. My name is Robin, and we have all the fiber.
I don't know where she went. Are you still there?
Hello?
Yes, hi. Okay, the nanotube question.
In reference to the nanotubes and the fiber optics, what is the difference between the two as far as the two technologies are concerned, and also who is manufacturing the nano fibers, and where are they doing it?
All right, both good questions. The difference between nanotube technology and fiber optics.
Okay, fiber optics is basically a fiber made of either glass or plastics or other clear materials, and it has two different types of material, an interior material and a cladding material. And each one has a different rate of allowing light to pass through it. The index of refraction is different. So what happens in fiber optics is the light is actually confined to a pathway inside the fiber so that it emerges pretty much as it was when it entered the fiber. The nanotubes are entirely different materials. They're made of carbon atoms, and the carbon atoms are put together in a sort of a spiral that forms a tiny tube about 1/1,000,000th of a meter across, 1 nanometer in size. But they can be very long, just as a hair is tiny in size, but very long. The nanofibers aren't actually related to fiber optics at all. They're intended to be a very high-strength, high-tensile-strength material and could end up replacing a lot of things in, let's say, bulletproof vests, as well as making the space elevator.
All right. And her follow-up question was, Sir Charles, who is currently doing this manufacturing?
I think there's a company called Microsystems and Applied Sciences also that is working on the nanotubes right now. I know that Applied Sciences is. And there are a number of small companies that are working on it that we don't really hear a lot because they're under the wire. But I think Applied Sciences is one of the largest manufacturers at this point.
Okay. I've heard some pretty exciting stuff about paint you can put on your house for getting energy and that sort of thing. You've heard about that?
Oh, yes. Because of the fact that these nanofibers act almost as antennas do, or light waves, you know, antennas for radio waves can pick up the energy.
Right.
These fibers can be tuned to light waves, and they could convert it, theoretically, into electrical current. So nanofiber coatings, paints, could become the next solar cell.
All right, good enough. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hi.
Hi, Arthur. Hi, Sir Charles. I was curious about the so-called phenomenon of the Cambrian explosion, how, you know, all the modern phyla of animals seem to appear all at once without gradually evolving from a common ancestor, and I'm wondering if this Cambrian explosion might have occurred more slowly on Mars, and then as the Martian climate became periodically a desert and then wet again, and the deserts got longer and longer in duration and time, the cysts got better and better at handling harsh conditions and then survived an asteroid splash, and they got planted here on Earth, and that's why there's a Cambrian explosion here, because the common ancestors occurred on Mars. And if that's true, then maybe we could still find cysts that could hatch into trilobites on Mars, or places where they're still existing in little puddles, and we could get to see living trilobites. I'm wondering what you have to say about this.
Well, understand that when the Cambrian explosion occurred, and this is a period early in Earth's history, about 500 million years ago, when all of a sudden life became very complex. There were huge changes in our atmosphere, lots of free oxygen, and small organisms showed up that began becoming all different sorts of life forms. Now, most of these don't show up in the fossil record because they are such delicate and small objects. However, enough has shown up to show us that suddenly there was a huge amount of diversity in life on Earth. Similar processes appear to have occurred on Mars, and whether they occurred more quickly or more slowly is hard to say. But the thought of an asteroid impact carrying all these organisms one planet to the other has some problems. Some bacteria could probably make it very easily, but larger organisms are much more fragile than bacteria, and they stand a far worse chance of surviving such a transfer. So if organisms were carried from one planet to the other by asteroid or meteor impacts, it probably would be nothing much larger than spores or bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
There may be a relation.
Why should we be any more concerned about NASA returning a sample from Mars than we are about a Mars rock reentering our atmosphere, entering our atmosphere, and then coming down and cracking open on the ground and spreading something?
Well, actually, that's an easy one to answer.
Okay.
When a Mars rock is removed from the planet, it's typically blasted off the planet by an impact, such as an asteroid or a meteor.
Right.
When this happens, the rock is subjected to a great deal of stress and heat. It has to rip through the atmosphere very rapidly in order to escape from the planet. And it may be incandescent when that happens. When it travels through space, it typically takes many millions to tens of millions of years to reach the Earth. And organisms don't tend to survive for tens of millions of years. As it is right now, it takes special conditions such as being frozen or stuck in a salt crystal for an organism to last from thousands to millions of years.
Hmm.
So by the time it reaches the Earth, now it's gone through our atmosphere as well. And it's been pretty thoroughly sterilized and quarantined, so we don't really have many things to worry about from Martian meteorites.
You would certainly be uniquely qualified to answer this, Sir Charles. If a Martian sample came back, after all you've seen and demonstrated on your website about Mars, and we had a Martian sample sitting in front of us, would you be in the same room when they opened it?
I certainly would not. I am extremely concerned about the possibility of organisms still extant or still living on the Martian surface, because it is proven to be wet. And in fact, you can see proof that it's wet, and it's been right under their noses all along. When you look at Meridiani, the surface of the plane is covered with trillions of identical little fossil spherules and rocks as well. So the question is, why are all the rocks and spherules on the surface? Any farmer knows the answer. If you plow a field and you remove the rocks preparatory to planting, and there's a freeze, the next day you come out and there's rocks in the field again. And this happens because of a process called frost heave. When there's moisture in the soil and it freezes, ice pillars form and thrust all the rocks to the surface. Now, if this is true, we should see evidence of that on Mars, and we do. Where the heat shield crashed, the soil underneath it that it dug the trench in shows no rocks or spherules underneath it. So, if all the spherules and rocks are on the surface, some process put them there, and it is my theory that frost heave did it, and it's another confirmation that there's moisture in the soil.
So if you were on a board making a decision about bringing a sample back from Mars, you would urge caution, or you would want the project scrapped altogether, or what?
I wouldn't let it come any closer than the moon. I would not want it on the Earth. I certainly wouldn't want it in an orbital station, because orbital stations can re-enter, and not everything burns up. If we had it on the moon, then I wouldn't feel so bad about it. If it was quarantined there in the proper biological facilities, that would be fine.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. How are you doing today?
Just great.
I'm calling from the oil sands capital of the world, up here in Fort McMurray, Alberta.
Yes, sir.
And just to let you know that, Sir Charles, China's already bought into the oil sands up here now. They bought into one of the future mines north of the existing mines. So they're already investing their money.
Did you were you aware of that, Sir Charles?
No, I wasn't.
Your prediction already is apparently coming true. They're sinking money
into
it already.
I've got to get out more.
Last month. And that's the only thing they can buy into, because there's so many companies buying up around the world here that they can't get their foot in the door anywhere else. So just let you know, Sir Charles, they're already up here.
Okay.
I appreciate
the information. That's amazing. So it's already occurring. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Good morning.
Edna, if you're still listening, JC's a madman. Make a run for it while you can.
All right. Thank you. Yes, we're well aware of that. First time caller line, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to start this brief conversation here by saying everyone that, across the planet has heard the common saying of think globally, act locally. Well, I just wanted to say that I believe it's time. I also have a question, but I believe it's time for us to start saying think universally, act globally. And it's time for us to step up. And one thing that has been the common thread in all the things that Sir Charles talks about is the centralization of everything that has to do with energy. So we're not able to provide for ourselves. And my question for you, Sir Charles, is I believe decentralization would help people to be able to contribute and act globally or locally, or however you want to say it. But a question is, there's devices. I'd just like to hear your comment and tell me that this is not possible. If you take a regenerative solid oxide fuel cell that's taken and hydrogen in and is also regenerating some of that hydrogen back out as fuel, and then is outputting its heat, which is significant, to a Stirling engine device, which is a heat engine, which is capable of working on a free piston type system and turning the heat into energy, taking the energy from the solid oxide fuel cell, as well as taking the hydrogen that comes back out from the regenerative fuel cell. Is it not possible that we have the technology right now right here on Earth to deploy to people, just to make it commercially viable and available through just common plastics. And it, and I also like to say,
okay, hold on, sir. That's a lot to comment on. So hold right there, please. Okay. In other words, does this kind of system exist now? Could it be deployed? Could it be done? Are we just ignoring it? Are the oil companies burying it? What's the deal?
Okay, any system that consumes fuel has a loss. And if it's generating fuel, when it's consuming fuel, there's going to be a loss on the way. So it's going to make less than you want. It's kind of like putting a windmill on the hood of your car and hoping it'll charge the battery up without using the energy from your fuel. You're getting that same energy out of the fuel back into the system less efficiently than you would with a regular generator. So a system that made its own fuel that way is going to lose. It's a losing proposition because it's a perpetual motion machine, and thermodynamics just doesn't permit that to happen. On the other hand, he had a good point. We need to start acting individually as well so that we have a global effect. I did a calculation that showed that over 12.6 trillion watts of sunlight heating occurs on just the rooftops of our homes in this country.
That's amazing.
If we were simply to make the roofs reflective or silver, we'd eliminate an immense load on our air conditioning. And if we actually use it to generate power, you could have your air conditioning essentially for free. Depends on how much it costs to set up, however.
Well, I think the kind of world that you describe cannot be far off, or put another way, had better not be very far off. Looking at current conditions. Sir Charles, it has been a pleasure having you here tonight. Our time has evaporated.
Well,
much like the water on Mars. Okay, my friend, thank you so very much, and good luck.